because we have a quorum now. The Senate Education Committee on February 16th, 2016. And thank you for being here.
It does help to have a quorum.
So with that, we have at the beginning an informational hearing. So I'm going to open an informational hearing about youth and government and invite our distinguished governor to come forward. And if you didn't know that we have another governor in Oregon, we do as of this moment, and she's going to explain what's going on in our chambers the next couple of days.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Erica Harrison, and I'm a senior at Sprague, and as you were just told, I've been lucky enough to be elected youth governor of Oregon for this year. So first, I want to talk to you about what youth and government is, and then I'll discuss why this activity is so particularly impactful to its participants. Each year, high school students pair up with another student to sponsor a bill to be enacted by the Oregon state government. This bill can be on any topic, and participants definitely take advantage of that, pursuing some sometimes outlandish subjects they feel will make a positive impact on Oregonians. Throughout the year, students learn how to format and write measures, practice parliamentary procedure, and engage in intensive research on their chosen topic. Last year, my friend Kaylee, who wrote a bill to disallow public schools to ban books, could by the conference list off nearly every book that had ever been banned in Oregon from memory. All this effort is to present their bills here at the annual three-day conference in the Capitol building, where everyone hopes to pass their bill through their committee, the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, all of which are completely student-run. The bill writing process is great in its own right, but I think the truly extraordinary thing about this program starts to happen when everyone comes together with their own ideas to discuss what they've written. Subjects range widely from politically topical issues to entirely new and fresh ideas that you would never have thought of before, but that actually make a lot of sense. I think you'll find it surprising the number of bills that are on entirely nonpartisan issues. Of course, there are bills to regulate wages or abortion or other political topics, but there are also bills on granting 17-year-olds who will be 18 by the general election the right to vote in the primary, which I hear has been recently introduced on the real legislative floor. And this year, there is even a bill to allow Eastern Oregon to vote on whether or not they want to become their own state called New Idaho to grant them greater political representation. While some of these bills may seem impractical, each and every student is passionate about their ideas and has put months into researching their topic with their co-sponsor. Opportunity for outside-the-box measures and discussions makes youth and government truly enjoyable year after year because you never know what ideas will come up and what kind of weird opinions people you thought you knew have. These out-of-the-ordinary discussions force students to consider their beliefs about politics beyond what they're already comfortable identifying with and think critically about the relationship between government, society, and individual. Here, students discover their own big-picture ideologies instead of just espousing a predetermined argument on whether or not they believe in a higher minimum wage. Youth in government grooms Oregonians who are actively engaged in political thought and who are ready to take on whatever challenges face our civilization in the future. In addition to expressing political ideas that are rarely discussed in the real government, this program also allows students to develop other skills that come with being an elected representative, like public speaking, trading yes votes on bills, and desperately telling everyone to support your bid for governor. In committee, everyone gets to discuss their own bills and talk about others, and here every student involved usually ends up speaking and becomes comfortable expressing themselves. Later, on the House and Senate floors, even the people who are usually quiet and reserved come alive during heated debates on whether to give citizens a tax credit for voting or introduce more rehabilitation programs in prisons. Speaking here gives students a newfound sense of confidence that they wouldn't otherwise have and instills them with the belief that political opinions are still worth discussing, even during a time when many people think our politics are beyond saving. I've always been a people person, but even my limits were pushed when I had to introduce myself to complete strangers and ask them to support me when I ran for governor. After feeling awkward the first couple of times, I soon got into a rhythm with how to introduce myself in a friendly way and talk to people in such a way that would earn their vote. I can honestly say that since I was elected, I have not even been mildly nervous to engage with any stranger, and this kind of character growth is common among nearly all participants. As our conference continues here in the Capitol over the course of the next 3 days, I encourage you to talk to some of the participants if you are interested in hearing their personal stories about what youth and government has done for them. Once you get them talking, you won't be disappointed, and I'm sure you'll hear some hilarious stories about interesting things delegates have said on the floor in the past years. Please take advantage of all the students here at the conference who can attest this program's acumen if you're interested. I'm sure any one of them would feel like the most special person in the whole world if they were pulled aside by a real senator or representative to talk about their bill. On Friday afternoon and Saturday, you are free to go sit in the House or Senate galleries and watch the debate for yourself and see what kinds of unique and insightful argumentation is happening at any given time. I will either be in the galleries myself or in the governor's ceremonial office during that time, so you are also welcome to come say hi to me and chat with me one-on-one if you would like. In addition, we are having a reception in the Senate lobby tonight at 5, where you will have the opportunity to meet advisors and talk in more depth about the program. You will also have the opportunity to hear my wonderful voice again, as I will be speaking there about what youth and government means to me a little bit more personally. I hope to see you all again later, and I will take questions now if you have any.
Okay. Any questions? And just so you know, it's really great to have someone who can talk at about 25% faster than the rest of us, because we can hear much quicker than we can usually talk. But I appreciate, because we asked her to make it short, you know, and get it done, and she got more words in than most people will in the time she got them in. I do appreciate it. And what was amazing to me, it was also very articulate, so I could hear everything, and I knew what you were saying. So I was impressed. Any questions for the rest of the group?
Very good. No questions.
I do want to say, in the back of the room, we have some of the board members from Oregon Youth and Government, one of whom was herself a past president of that group, Amanda Dalton. And then Judy Hall is right there as well, so many of us in the Senate know her well and appreciate your work. And I know we have some advisors up here who are also part of the Youth and Government program. So thank you all for being here, and thank you very much for your introduction. And I hope people do spend some time. I've been on the board for a long time as well, and a number of people in this building have gone through Youth and Government programs. Some of our past senators and others have taken advantage of this program and then taken the next step in being involved in their local governments and actually at state government. So thank you very much for being here. And we look forward to seeing you as a colleague at some point in the future. So we're going to close our informational hearing. We had a couple public hearings that we ran out of time. We went very late, but we ran out of time. So we're going to get a couple pieces of hopefully short testimony before we start our other bill today. So the first one is finishing up the public hearing on Senate Bill 204, Teaching with a Purpose. And we're going to do a phone thing because at the end we had a lot of people here. We got kicked out of the building at 5:15 because there was another committee coming in here. So you can go ahead and dial. Thank you. So we're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 204. When people come from a ways and then they don't get to talk, it's not very fair.
People come from and then they don't get to talk.
Hello?
Hello. This is Senator Arne Roblin. Is this Tanya? So we're taking your testimony on Senate Bill 204, and we're asking it to be relatively short, so go ahead.
Excellent. I'm watching you online as well. So.
Very good. And don't forget to introduce yourself. Yeah.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin and members of the Senate Committee on Education. My name is Tanya Lubis, and I'm a faculty member and direct the Center for Culturally Responsive Practices at Eastern Oregon University. The purpose of this testimony today is to request your approval and moving forward of SB 204, which is funding that directs ODE in a collaborative partnership with the Teaching with Purpose Consortium to establish a culturally responsive practices and certification program for school districts and educators across Oregon. As you know, we have many excellent laws concerning educational equity in Oregon, but there is often little accountability attached to them. So this law would create a certification and training and accountability program for school districts and public educators to ensure culturally responsive practices are actually being employed. While I recognize there has been some concern pertaining to the specific details of the law or the proposed bill, implementation and accountability, I do want to speak to the idea of partnerships and collaboration because I think this is something that hasn't been addressed. The Teaching with Purpose Consortium specifically is something that I am a member of and is made up of leading scholars and educational stakeholders across the state. We meet once a month. Some of the scholars include Dr. Geneva Gay, who's one of the principal theorists on culture responsive teaching. Over the past year, we've worked together to discuss equity in education, including accountability in the state of Oregon. This is one of the first consortium of its kind where we actually have primary theorists and scholars who are experts in equity work and culturally responsive teaching who come and are part of the partnership and consultation. Accountability and consistency are very, very important as we pursue this work. The work cannot be done within a silo of the school district. Rather, the work should be done collaboratively, and we must have a consistent means of accountability. So the proposal in and of itself has some excellent ideas, and coming up with a common measurement tool is something that I very much support. I think that we need to have a common, consistent, trainable mechanism to look at how we're meeting the needs of our learners in schools, but there also needs to be partnerships and training to meet the individual district needs and the needs of our students across the state of Oregon. In a partnership with the consortium, the Center for Culture Responsive Practices at EOU will serve as a research center and fiscal agent. We'll provide evidence-based research support and culture responsive practices, which we've been doing for the last few years. And the center will aid in the process. So funding for this initiative would certainly enable the organizations to provide training and foster strong partnerships with the goal of creating continuity between home and school. And it will be aimed to ensure accountability for equity and produce forward momentum in the transformation of our education system into one that's more equitable and generates genuine change. So I kindly urge you to look at moving this bill forward, and I would happily answer any questions that you may have for me at this time.
I don't see any questions. So I appreciate you taking the time to comment, and as we go forward, we'll keep you informed.
Thank you so much, and have a nice day.
Thank you. So who wants to go to these? No, just go ahead and where there's one more. And I will say there were a couple other people who have sent in written testimony, and we will look at that just as much as the real, and we appreciate the effort to expedite that by having the written testimony. So thank you. Hello, is this John?
No, Senator Roblin, this is Matthew Ruddy again.
Okay. Are you willing, are you here to testify for John Washington?
I am.
Okay.
He is in the process of helping us with a few other efforts.
Okay.
And I have some of the follow-up that he had wanted me to share.
Okay. Do so as quickly as you can. Thank you.
Absolutely. I'd like to speak directly to a part that had been mentioned on Tuesday as well. That is Section 1, Part 2, and Part B of the amendment. And there's been further discussion on the sentences, lines 15 through 18, and that is promoting a culture for safe and inclusive learning environments by encouraging collaboration among students and families and by seeking input from students and families in evaluating cultural responsiveness. What we've been asked to share further is the hypothetical question, can any district, school, or educator already claim to be culturally responsive? And if so, then they're definitely invited to share that information, their proof, and their process in doing so. And we would think that that would mean that all or most of the students and families in those districts feel that their needs are being met in terms of gender, orientation, ethnicity, economic standing, and more. So we're stating this because it is a needs-based thing on current outcomes around high school graduation rates, test scores, and student testimony. What we're stipulating is that we feel those feelings are valid and fair based on those current outcomes. The follow-up of what we wanted to address is that the OSBA did have some very particular questions that we found very useful, particularly pertaining to the certification process and what the mechanism would be. And one of the things that we wanted to follow up on is that the mechanism is not yet concrete because the Teaching with Purpose Consortium needs the cooperation and input from students and families along with district schools and educators. We can't do this work without everybody's input, and we're not pretending that we can. We are presenting ourselves as facilitators of a process and not a demanding and inflexible mandate. So the apprehension for additional work, additional cost, and additional training is certainly fair and would not be ignored. This is precisely why current educators and administrators are asked to be included. We do want to point out that there have been many instances of programs that plan for and allocate funding for and are built around things that do not physically exist yet. As an example, the original design for the Hubble telescope required technology that didn't even exist. But after 20 years of hard work, it has now yielded 26 years of deep space exploration. So what we are requesting is an exponentially smaller amount of resources and time and effort and funding for this collaboration, because we're interested in the deep space exploration of the minds and identities of how all of our children are learning and what would serve them best. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about that, but we wanted to make sure that that got passed along as well.
Thank you very much. I see no questions, and I appreciate you taking the time to finish up the testimony from our Senate bill. Thank you.
Thanks again, Senator Roblin. It's very much appreciated.
Okay, thank you. So with that, we have met the requirement of finishing up Senate Bill 204 and getting all the testimony. And I, again, appreciate those people who have submitted written instead of taking the time today. And we will continue to work on with this bill with the information that we've gathered. So I'm going to close the public hearing on work on Senate Bill 204. I think I'll hold on until she comes back. So we're going to open a public hearing.
That's her bill. This next one is her bill.
Gelsers. Mm-hmm. I guess we're going to move down the list since I don't see the people I want here. So we're going to go to Senate Bill. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 414. And Senator Johnson, you want to come up? We'll have a short explanation of the bill.
Thank you. By leave of the chair, I am accompanied by a distinguished panel. May they come up at the same time?
Only because you asked.
Thank you.
Yes.
Cummings.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 414 establishes a student threat assessment system in the Oregon Department of Education consisting of regional threat assessment teams. It establishes program and training requirements. It directs the State Board of Education to adopt rules related to the student threat assessment system, including the establishment of school-based threat assessment teams, protocols for those teams, and district-wide community multidisciplinary threat assessment teams.
Thank you. And with that, Senator Johnson, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm, for the record, Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, and I'm going to provide just the briefest of overviews and allow my distinguished colleagues to get into the substance of the bill. I have had the honor, privilege, and responsibility of having served on the School Safety Task Force, and out of that initiative have come a number of recommendations that I think will be extraordinarily useful in this delicate and dangerous series of topics that we took up. One of the things that has nothing to do with Senate Bill 414, but I want to call to your attention, is the peer counseling work being done by Lines for Life, where they have students handling calls from students in complicated situations that could result in harm to others or themselves. And I think that that Lines of Life investment that came out of the work of the School Safety Task Force has been enormously beneficial, as I do the elements of Senate Bill 414. 414 establishes a school-based student threat assessment system. And it is my privilege to introduce to you Dr. Dave Novotny from the Salem-Keizer School District, John Van Driel, and Lieutenant Dave Okada from Salem Police to speak to you about the substance of the bill. I am going to vacate this seat to make room at the table, and I will retire to my own committee. Thank you very much for the courtesy of allowing myself to publicly associate myself with this fine piece of public policy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
And you think they could answer questions as well as you could?
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the Senate Committee on Education. For the record, my name is Dave Novotny, and I work as the superintendent of the Willamette Education Service District. I want to apologize in advance for my voice. As you know, it's been a nasty cold and flu season, so I do apologize for that. I'm appearing today as Vice Chair of the Oregon Task Force on School Safety in support of Senate Bill 414 to talk about the importance of creating a statewide student threat assessment system for Oregon schools. I am one of the authors of a proposal submitted to the Oregon Task Force on School Safety in 2015 titled A Statewide Threat Assessment System for Oregon Schools. The proposal received the unanimous support from the task force members, and a copy has been provided to you in advance of my testimony. The concept for Senate Bill 414 was developed from that proposal. During my testimony today, I will address how the proposal of the statewide student threat assessment system will operate, and then my two colleagues will address the specifics related to student threat assessment. With me today to provide testimony are two nationally recognized experts in the field of threat assessment, Mr. John Van Driel and Lieutenant Dave Okada. Mr. Van Driel and Lieutenant Okada will address what student threat assessment is and is not, how it operates, and the benefits that a student threat assessment system brings to help maintain safety in schools. Mr. Vandrill's biography was submitted to you in advance of his testimony today. Briefly, however, he is a school psychologist and the director of safety and risk management services for the Salem-Keizer School District. He has over 30 years of experience in psychoeducational evaluation, crisis assessment, behavioral intervention, and systems consultation. In 1999, he began the development and implementation of the Salem-Keizer model, a multi-agency student threat assessment system. And for the record, the Salem-Keizer model is considered an exemplar at the national level. Through that collaboration, he has worked daily with educators, law enforcement, trial court personnel, juvenile justice and mental health professionals in the assessment and management of youth. He is also the editor and principal author of the book Assessing Student Threats, a Handbook for Implementing the Salem-Keizer System. He regularly provides training and consultation on threat assessment systems to regional and national audiences and is considered a national expert in student threat assessment systems. Also with me today is Lieutenant Dave Okada from the Salem Police Department. Lieutenant Okada has served in law enforcement for over 30 years and has been working in the threat assessment field since 2000. He is also a recognized expert and regularly provides consulting services and training on student threat assessment issues around the nation. Lieutenant Okada has served on the National Board of Directors of the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals, known as ATAP, since 2007 and received the 2009 ATAP Presidential Recognition Award for his contributions to the field. He is currently the facilitator of the Willamette Valley Adult Threat Assessment Advisory Team and is also a member of the Mid-Valley Student Threat Assessment Team. His full biography was also submitted to you in advance of his testimony today. The reason I took a little bit of time to talk about these two colleagues of mine, just to make the point that I think we are incredibly fortunate to have two nationally recognized experts in the field of threat assessment in our backyard. And as we develop a statewide system to support Oregon schools, I don't think we have to look any further than Mr. Vandrill and Lieutenant Okada. To begin my portion of the testimony, I would first like to thank the legislature for having the foresight to establish a task force to focus on improving the safety of our schools. Under the leadership of Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts, the Oregon Task Force on School Safety has been very active in advancing several recommendations to make our schools a safer place for students and staff. In its report to the Oregon Legislature in 2015, the task force identified two key recommendations as critical next steps for improving the safety of our schools. One was to develop a statewide school safety tip line that would allow students and staff to confidentially report threats or perceived threats to student safety. And the second recommendation was to develop a statewide student threat assessment system to help schools respond effectively to those tips. We believe these two systems are inextricably connected and working together, they will save lives. We are pleased to report that the task force first recommendation has been successfully implemented. On January 31st, just a couple weeks ago, 2017, the Oregon State Police launched the school-wide safety tip line known as Safe Oregon, and students are already using the system. With your support of Senate Bill 414, we can take the next critical step towards safer schools by developing a statewide student threat assessment system to help schools respond effectively to threats of aggression and suicide risk. Currently in our state, some schools have a student threat assessment system in place, like Salem-Keizer School District, Beaverton, and 18 other school districts in the three-county area, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties, but most do not. We believe that all Oregon schools need a structure that ensures needed support and decreases risk of harm regardless of resources. Please remember that student threat assessment is recommended as a best practice by the U.S. Department of Education, the FBI, and the U.S. Secret Service. Members of the Oregon Task Force on School Safety also recommend student threat assessment as a best practice in our state. If you wouldn't mind, if you could please refer to the document titled A Statewide Threat Assessment System for Oregon Schools that was submitted. There is an organizational chart on page 9 that you may want to reference. If not, I'll be able to walk you through it. This is how we perceive a statewide system to be organized in the state of Oregon. First of all, we believe that there will be full statewide coverage and that every school district in the state of Oregon should have access to a threat assessment professional. The system would be administered by the Oregon Department of Education. There would be one employee at the Department of Education that we would call a program administrator to oversee the entire program. We believe that there would also need to be a steering committee of 6 to 8 individuals, could be experts in the field such as Mr. Vandrill or Lieutenant Okada, that can help guide the development of a statewide program. Underneath that program administrator, we anticipate needing 14 FTE, which would be regional threat assessment specialists in the state of Oregon, 8 to 12 regions. What we really anticipate, I'm going to use our region as an example. We have about 84,000 students in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. Salem-Keizer has about half of that student population, about 41, 42,000. They have their region covered. The other 41,000 students in our region are covered by one FTE, so we believe that one regional threat assessment specialist should be able to interact with schools and school districts that have about 41,000 students on average. Right now, we're serving an additional 18 school districts, okay, with that one FTE. The estimated cost for this type of model for the state of Oregon would be about $4.1 million for the biennium. On behalf of the Oregon Task Force on School Safety, I would like to thank Senator Johnson for sponsoring this bill, and I would also like to thank Representative Barker for his participation on the task force. The members of the task force urge your support of Senate Bill 414. And at this time, I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Vandrill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Rublin and members of the Committee of Education. I am John Vandrill. I'm the Director of the Safety and Risk Management Services for Salem-Keizer School District. My office is located at 2450 Lancaster Drive Northeast in Salem. I am here in support of Senate Bill 414, and to that effect, I've provided a list of frequently asked questions for your review. They've been submitted. However, I won't directly address those questions unless you, at the end of the testimony, require further detail or clarification. So what I'd like to do today is simply do an overview of the system, what it accomplishes, and how it is accessed in kind of simple form. I've worked as a psychologist, as Dr. Novotny said, for 30 years. And in that term and tenure, my focus has been on aggressive and disruptive youth. In 1999, I was directed by my superintendent to create a formal threat assessment structure for the Salem-Keizer School District, and that system became the first of its kind in the nation. In doing so, I used the findings of the Safe Schools Initiative, a study that was conducted by the United States Secret Service and the United States Department of Education. I used that information prior to their publication. They were writing white papers on that. I also combined that with an FBI monograph at the time on targeted violence and everything I could find from the experts in the field. Additionally, I collaborated with my colleagues in education, law enforcement, public mental health, juvenile department, and Oregon Youth Authority. And we did this in order to ensure that the system was not only functional but accomplished the outcomes intended and was user-friendly. Following the recommendations of the experts, we as a collaborative group determined that the assessment would focus on context rather than be an evaluation of a student, and this eliminated any possibility of profile or labeling. That all occurred around the year 2000. Through the years to follow, I frequently surveyed school staff, mostly administrators and counselors, regarding the use of the system to improve the psychological safety of their environment as well as the physical safety, as demonstrated by better access to mental health services, law enforcement support, and the perception of an improved well-being within that milieu. The results of those surveys were very consistent. Over 90% of administrators and counselors believe that the system accomplished those goals. One of those studies is referenced in your frequently asked questions. As I mentioned, psychological safety is one of the goals. And psychological safety is accomplished when staff and students believe that their school is safer because the staff in that school or the district and the community are doing everything they can with the available resources and the information they have. And psychological safety, simply put, is a sense of well-being that allows those staff and those students to use their brains to focus on teaching and learning rather than worry about their safety. Psychological safety can occur when that brain is functioning, but it cannot occur if staff and students are in fear, because the part of their brain that controls fear causes a fight, flight, or freeze response. And that interferes with the part of the brain that is involved in education and teaching and learning. That's the part of the brain that not only learns but plays music, makes art, maintains relationships, teaches, and solves complex problems. So in other words, when you're in fear, you're worried about your well-being, you can't learn and you can't teach. So one of the intentions of this program was to ease those worries by doing everything we can. So this well-established threat assessment system improves education simply by improving the learning environment and decreasing that fear-based anxiety. In addition to psychological safety, which is, as I mentioned, a key point to the system, the threat assessment system also accomplishes two other very important tasks. First, the system provides intervention and supervision for students who are considering violent, suicidal, or otherwise very dangerous behavior. It is easily accessed by staff or parents when a potentially threatening or seriously harmful situation is detected. The system is intuitively managed and simple in administration, allowing for a very quick turnaround with a referral. Now, currently in Oregon, there are a number of districts and regions that use very diagnostic-heavy or profiling evaluations conducted by either community agencies or mental health agencies, often waiting days, even weeks, to address situations that are seriously threatening to staff and students. These methods are not only ineffective, but they can actually increase risk because school staff can be pacified by the promise of an assessment and intervention scheduled at a later date and thus neglect the kinds of safety precautions that they need to conduct in the short term. Furthermore, if a student is indefinitely suspended or expelled from campus while awaiting a lengthy mental health evaluation, unless that student is very well supervised by parents, the student actually poses a greater risk to the staff or the possible targets on campus because the folks on campus don't know where that student is. So if the student is thinking of harming people on campus, the folks on campus don't have any way of monitoring or supervising the students. Thus, a timely and efficient process such as the proposed model that investigates threatening or dangerous situations may make the difference between a youth's successful intervention and a harmful, if not lethal, trajectory. Second, the system examines variables of risk and thus notes when they do not exist. Even though rumors or reports may mark a student or students as dangerous because of those threatening communications. While a communication that is threatening is one of those variables, it is only an attention getter most of the time. There are many other variables that are far more serious than the communication of the threat. Some of those variables are planning to act out violence, rehearsing, scheduling, or establishing a motive. These are the risk factors that increase concern within the assessment process because they establish that a student is engaged in behavior that supports the idea of acting out the violence. So when a threatening communication is made, which can frequently happen with a number of our youth, but the situation lacks the other risk factors that I just noted, a threat assessment can actually be helpful in decreasing staff, parent, and student worry because it makes note of the lack of risk factors. So it more or less exonerates a student when that is simply a communication. In this way, the assessment provides support for the appropriate intervention, which would address the irresponsible communication, but does not further interfere with the student's life. Furthermore, the threat assessment in this situation would validate a decrease of concern, eliminating labeling, stopping rumors, or further branding the student as dangerous. In other words, threat assessments don't just identify or detect genuine threats. They're very valuable in identifying benign threats, decreasing the kind of over-identification and stigmatization that can occur when people end up in a reactive stance after a communication is made. In short, as Dr. Novotny said, the student threat assessment system is a set of assessment and safety planning procedures overseen and administered by a collaborative group of community agencies that serve youth. The primary goal of the system is to diffuse threats and physical harm caused by those threats, and the system also reduces the overreaching responses of zero tolerance policies that often result in an inflated number of students being either excluded or expelled. The system does this by eliminating labels, providing proactive student support and supervision, and maintaining a positive, non-punitive, minimally invasive structure of investigation centered around situational risk factors and intervention that appropriately address the risk factors rather than reactively. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have, or wait until Lieutenant
O'Connor is done. We'll wait until.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Dave Okada. I'm a lieutenant with the Salem Police Department. As Dr. Novotny indicated, I've been working in threat assessment since 2000. I chair the adult community-based threat advisory team, and I also sit on the student threat assessment team, as does Mr. Vandrill. Mr. Vandrill has given you background information and basic information in terms of the operation of the Mid-Valley Student Threat Assessment Team. So I'm here today to address the team operations and how the various disciplines work together. As Mr. Vandrill has talked about, is we assess situational risk factors that are based on research done by the U.S. Secret Service, the FBI, and the U.S. Department of Education and other entities. We are assessing these indicators, not individual people. The system is based on multi-agency, multidisciplinary collaboration and cooperation and working very closely together. We're not profiling. We're not assessing individuals. We're looking at the context of the situation that they're in, and Mr. Vangel describes some of the differences that we look at there. Law enforcement is just one of many disciplines represented on both of our teams. We all bring a special set of skills, knowledge, experience, and resources to the table, and every member of our team is equal. We're not heavily law enforcement or education, so we rely on every single member to contribute evenly and equally to the assessment, as well as the discussion of supervision strategies and management strategies and the coordinated resources going out to that student as well. We ask that every member participates equally in the discussions as well as the assessments. We always bring our special sets and skills and resources, and we rely on everybody to have those available to them at the table. We all have equal say, as I said, and everybody's valuable. We also choose our team members in terms of their experience in their own profession. Every team member needs to understand the guidelines and the rules of their own disciplines as they come to the table, and other team members need to respect those guidelines and rules as well. So in other words, we're working together, respecting each other's boundaries where we are, so we can eliminate those silos and work together to come up with a productive solution and prevention strategy. The team works as a unified body. We discuss the issues, we come to consensus, and we coordinate the activities. In other words, we agree on how we're going to coordinate the activities, and we follow through with those, and we review those on a regular basis. We've adopted the phrase, first we do no harm, which is a medical phrase, but we need to understand that whatever management strategies are put into place, it could change the situation. And so we're constantly reevaluating that to make sure that management strategies are working the way we want them to work and that we're maintaining the safety of our schools. That's a quick summary, and I'm happy to answer questions as well.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this group?
No, I don't have any.
Any questions?
I've got a question.
Yes. Senator Gelser.
Thank you. So in the materials, when it talked about the risk factors or triggers, it mentioned non-normative sexual behavior. And when I Googled non-normative sexual behavior, it looked like that could be something that might target students that are not cisgender or students that are gay, lesbian, or bisexual. what is intended by that and what protects LGBTQ students in their districts from not being targeted by a system like this with that type of language?
That's an excellent question. So the term non-normative, as we've adopted it within what we call our Sexual Incident Response Committee, is more narrowly defined than probably the material you found, I'm guessing. It's simply developmentally non-normative. So often kids do engage in certain kinds of activities, even at a young age. And so that the system has a process of detecting that and examining it and determining if it is normative. Obviously, it still can't occur at school, but if it moves beyond that, and I won't, I'm trying to think of the right word, in a manner that needs more than simply redirection, so needs supervision, and that assessment moves forward to our, what we call our level two school psych lead psychologist. The groups you mentioned would not be targeted just by directive and policy of the district and wouldn't fall within that, the definitions of our system's explanation of non-normative, and we can get you those protocols to look at because they're very well explained within our system.
Follow-up?
Yeah, I'd be glad to.
Could you give a specific example of a non-normative sexual behavior in a youth and when it would be appropriate for a school district to decide what was appropriate in terms of sexual or gender expression of a young person? And it seems very alarming to me. I think a lot of the language, and I recognize this is coming from more of a law enforcement perspective. I certainly come from more of a human services and education perspective, but these are children and youth, and this language is frightening to me that it could put really vulnerable kids at more risk.
Certainly understand that. The perspective of the system is actually heavily education. So there's, I would say, completely written by from an education perspective. So the non-normative, the definitions of that, and I'll give you one, would be imagine a fifth or sixth grader soliciting some sort of sexual act in the bathroom. That moves beyond what might be a normal kind of sexual practice or act or investigation or exploratory move of a sixth grader who might be curious about that and have the discussion. But if that sixth grader solicits that act or continues to do so, then obviously we would need to increase supervision within that environment.
So follow up. So I've spent a lot of time with middle schoolers and high schoolers, and it would not seem unusual to me that a sixth grader or a seventh grader might be kissing or touching or exploring that in a bathroom or at the bleachers. Or, I mean, that's why we don't have kids close their bedroom doors when they're hanging out with other kids. I guess that increased my concern.
That certainly, yeah. So kissing and what we would call light petting, if that's what you're describing, is within kind of a normative range in that age group. That's why I used fifth, sixth grader, because there is a transition there where some of that becomes more normative. Within the school environment, however, if that moves forward, and especially if someone is declining that request, that becomes a supervision issue at some point. That's our stewardship. That's certainly our duty within the schools to make sure the other students are safe. The reason I use that example is it is a gray area. So the system steps in and examines that situation. Again, we're not labeling and we're not evaluating the individual. These are not psychosocial or psychosexual assessments. These are contextual assessments. So in that context, I'll just take you down the road of the evaluation. The context is examined. The developmental level of the students are examined, the number of, you know, generally the number of declines made by the responses from the student that's been approached would be examined. And within that, there are certain, I think there's latitude to make the consideration you're talking about with that age group, that some of that is normative behavior, depending on the age and the developmental. So if we were talking third graders, then we definitely would be out of that area pretty quickly of what would be normative.
Can I one more follow up?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Every answer makes me more concerned. I can't imagine being a sixth grade girl that is already very stressed out about my emerging sexuality, and then having my and doing that in a consensual way with whoever my so I get it on the non-consensual. I'm totally there. Consent is essential. But now there's this process where people are going to ask me questions about how many times have I done this and how did I feel, and I don't understand. I can understand violence. I can understand sexual assault being a trigger, but something that's called non-normative sexual behavior with the history that we have in our culture seems very dangerous and very traumatizing to kids, and I would think especially to girls and young women who are frequently judged for having any interest in sexuality whatsoever, and the idea that somebody somewhere has determined that, you know, it's normal, it's normative to be interested in, you know, the phrase that you used when you're a eighth grader, but not when you're a sixth grader. What does that sixth grader learn about herself? So this is very alarming to me. I would be curious to hear from others that do work in this field, but I'm especially concerned about the gender and the LGBTQ impacts, and all of the answers increased my level of anxiety and concern.
You want me to respond to that?
Sure.
That was the question? Okay. None of the things you mentioned would be identified as non-normative. The non-normative occurs when there are complaints, usually from parents or students or teachers, that things are exceeding what they consider normal. Then that is examined within a structure that is very well defined by professionals, looking at those levels. Now, I will say, if I can finish, that the vast majority of cases that are reviewed are explicitly and clearly inappropriate. Many of the kids that are supervised under our system within the Sexual Incident Response Committee are usually on supervision either through DHS or through the juvenile services. So the examples that we talked about, because of your question looking at LGBT population, when those kinds of incidents occur, the process is very careful, not stigmatizing, not interview or placing shame on anyone. It's examining that within the context of development, age, possibly disability. There are disability-related behaviors that sometimes fall within that category of might be non-normative, but it certainly wouldn't be a punitive action that we would take. And these are examples that are by far the more difficult examples to confront within schools. The easy ones are kids that are already identified, supervised either through juvenile justice or DHS.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, my final, again, that raised my concerns again. If I am a parent of a ninth grader who is transitioning from male to female or has come out as a lesbian and she is starting to date a girl, and now my parent, I'm doing this, I'm dating a girl or I'm transitioning, my parent is uncomfortable with that, they call the school, they start this process. So now not only do I have to deal with my own understanding, my school thinks that because of my sexuality, I'm gonna shoot up my school. I mean,
Your example is perfect, and that would not be reviewed. So parents are going to make those complaints one way or another. And the point that I was trying to make earlier with more of the threat assessment, because we're not tying shooting up schools to sexual acting out, by the way. If we indicated that, I apologize. The two aren't tied together. But parents are going to make those complaints. Students are going to make those complaints. If you don't have somewhat of an objective system to examine that so that you can dismiss the benign or normal unconcerning situations, and you do have people responding reactively. You do have rumor mills. You do have people going on witch hunts, so to speak, within the schools. And we saw that in Salem-Keizer about 9 years ago. And so when we developed the Sexual Incident Response Committee, it was in response to a number of kids that were mislabeled, certainly harassed within the school district because of some of those things that were within the gray areas. The windfall of the program is the kids that were on supervision, which approximately 160 kids when we do the tally every year within our district. Those 160 kids have very careful supervision, making sure that they don't act out again, thus maintaining their access to education, keeping that opportunity away from them if there are kids that would seize that opportunity, and moving them forward within the education system. So it was designed for both reasons, but absolutely that would not be a case or an example of anything that would go further than a complaint to a principal who would then examine that complaint within the structure we give them. So it's very tightly defined. Again, I can certainly, I'd be happy to provide you with that, those protocols that we've developed.
Just a quick comment. The paragraph that Senator Gelser was referring to on page 7 of 14 in the statewide threat assessment system doesn't tie it to shooting up a school, but it does tie it directly to fire-setting behavior that is destructive to the educational environment. So there may be concern there. My question, I'm just pointing that out for the record. My question is more particularly about the granularity and the conduct or grid that would be used to investigate all of these hard to identify and very subtle behaviors that we're describing. It seems it's very difficult to take this out of the individual arena that you're describing in these conversations and put it into a contextual conversation. I'm not sure I recognize how that granular understanding or grid work is created to ascertain which way it goes as you're trying to evaluate.
The questions are context-based, so the work that's done within our schools is not psychosexual work, which would be evaluations on the individual, looking at actually some of the concerns you were talking about. The contextual work is what is looking at the environment and adapting or shaping the environment to be less of a problem for a student who does act out on a regular basis or is attempting to act out. So when we look at context, we look at potential targets, and I'm speaking to the sexual incident work, not necessarily the others, although I can, they're contextually driven. So we look at, in that case, opportunity and supervision. If we're looking at kids that are under supervision, say with the Juvenile Justice Department, they've identified target groups, they've identified the kinds of restrictions and the kinds of supervisions that need to be in place, and then we use those identified guidelines to, again, shape that environment. Moving behavior in a positive direction is often about changing the environment for the students so that they can function or work within that education environment in a successful way. So the goal of this is to continually improve the education environment. And I will point out just quickly, I think I found, is this it? Sexual behavior, comma, and fire setting behavior. We don't intend the two to be linked. Those are four different assessment protocols. So you have suicidal behavior, threats against others, non-normative or sexual misbehavior, and fire setting. The protocols address each of those areas.
And then it goes on to say those are the four most concerning issues facing Oregon schools today. So even though there's a comma, the idea that a non-normative behavior is equated to, and maybe it's not intended to, but it's in a behavior and says that along with fire setting, threats, and suicide, it is one of the four most concerning issues facing Oregon schools today. And I thought it was our high school dropout rate.
Well, I would say suicide is a very big issue facing.
I would agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd say threats and violence and aggression within schools is quite alarming, although I will tell you schools are far safer than they were 20 years ago, in large part because of systems like the one we're telling you about. Sexual incidents and acting out depends on the city. So we have a lot of foster homes. We have a lot of institutions in our city. So we do have a greater number of students that are on supervision than other cities. Fire setting is not a particular concern that raises the same level of alarm as the other three. However, as long as you're running the protocols within a system, it's an easy thing to look at when kids are engaging in fire misbehavior. So we do know kids will light fires or go on camping trips. So it is included.
And Mr. Chair, I just have to say, foster youth are not inherently dangerous.
I'm not saying that they are.
You just indicated that you have increased threats because you have a lot of residential facilities and foster homes in your communities. Those kids tend to be disproportionately LGBTQ. Some of them tend to disproportionately engage in early onset sexual behavior that some might find non-normative.
We do have a lot of, we do have several homes and foster care facilities that have primarily, if not entirely, students that have acted out to the point of being in need of supervision. We have quite a few of those in the city. So in creating this system, we do address those students. We're able to manage their cases far more successfully than we were when we did not have the sexual incident response protocols added to what we call our threat response. So we added that. We started with the threat assessment in 99-2000. I think in about 07, we added the protocols to supervise kids that were acting out in with sexual misbehavior. But once again, I just want to be very clear that the populations you mentioned are not targeted in any way, shape, or form by these protocols. And again, it's context-driven. It's behavior-driven.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Okay. I do appreciate you being
Thank
here.
You.
And, Thank you, Senator.
We'll keep in touch. We have one more person, Cheryl Ramirez.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm here to express support for Senate Bill 414 as a promising practice that can reduce the threat of harm to self or others in school settings. As a mom of kids in the Salem-Keizer School District, I want to say that I'm very familiar with the lockdown drills aspect of the threat assessments. My kids always tell me when they've had a lockdown drill, and I hear from the schools, which I really appreciate. This morning when I was talking to my 12-year-old about this bill, she was able to rattle off the three threat levels for homicidal risk. And she knew the how and the why of how to respond to that risk, to that threat. In the second breath,
if we have 20 minutes, keep going.
Excuse me. Okay.
No, keep going. I'm sorry.
In the second breath, she talked about a friend of a friend who had mentioned thoughts of suicide, and I asked her, "Did your friend talk to her parents or other adults about this?" And she said she didn't know. And I told her, "You've got to tell your friend to tell her parents about this. It's very important." And then I subsequently called the mom because I was concerned. And so I guess what I'm saying here is I'd really like to see her know the how and the why of response to a suicidal risk, just like she knows what to do with the homicidal risk. She knows exactly what to do. As a member of the School Safety Task Force, I'm also well aware of the school safety tip line and its close connection with the school threat assessment system. Considering that suicide is the second leading cause of death among youth 10 to 24 years of age, I'd really like to see a clear, timely, and in some cases immediate response process from the call center to the community behavioral health system. And to that point, back to the bill, we would like to suggest some very minor language changes to make sure that that is clear. The first one is in the last line. We would just add, where it says processes for referrals, we would add to community behavioral health services and in addition to law enforcement and the juvenile justice system. And then the second suggestion for language change that we have is just nomenclature, where it says in lines 9 and 10 of page 2, a representative of a local mental health department, comma, a representative of a county mental health department. We would change it to read, a representative of a local mental health authority or a community mental health program. So just pretty minor. So thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony and suggest a couple of minor language changes.
Thank you. Any questions? I do want to say, having been a high school principal and having dealt with a number of suicides and other kinds of conditions like that, they are life-changing for people who were in charge and trying to protect kids, mm-hmm. and finding solutions that help us identify and get what people are needed, what students need, is really important, mm-hmm. For those of us who have had to deal with that kind of stuff on a personal level. It is never And I have had the opportunity to help give that information to parents because the activity took place not at school but during school hours. And parents came to pick up their mm-hmm. kids. And so knowing what that's like and how traumatic it is, not only to the family but to the whole school, it's really important that we figure out methods and criteria that help us identify and get the needed either medical or whatever information to those kids' families and work on.
Totally
so
agree.
Thank you,
Senator Rublin.
Anybody else that was going to speak to this one that didn't get their name on the list? Don't see anybody. So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 414. And we're going to rearrange some things. It took a little longer than we had thought it might. We have a group. Well, before that, let's do our work session since we're here right now. So we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 13. We'll have our administrator explain us exactly what that bill was, and then we'll take a motion.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 13 directs the Oregon Department of Education to develop a curriculum for grades 4 through 12 relating to the Native American experience in Oregon, make the curriculum available to school districts, and provide professional development to teachers and administrators. It establishes content requirements for the curriculum and requires implementation in the 2019-20 school year. It requires ODE to report on the status each October from 2018 to 2020. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. So, and it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It actually does.
Okay.
It actually does.
Oh, I will. I will take a motion from my vice
chair. Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 13 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee of Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Lithgow moves Senate Bill 13 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to this bill going to Ways and Means? I see none. It is passed. We will close our work session on Senate Bill 13. We have Senate Bill 318, and if we have some time afterwards, we will do it. But we're going to move to an informational hearing on optalexia because we have a guest from Sweden, and he's not going to make it back. So we thought it would be good to have...
That's more than 100 miles away.
And it's more than 100 miles away. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on an informational meeting. Hearing on optalexia. And if we have some time afterwards, we may get to the bill, at least get started.
And I apologize, Mr. Chair. I know my question slowed us down.
That's so okay. That's
it would be
fine.
Appropriate that Michael gets rolled over.
They were important questions, and that's what hearings are for.
Hello, my name is Robin Battison, and I'm a resident of Happy Valley. And I want to thank you, Senator Roblin, and the rest of the committee for this opportunity to discuss new technology for dyslexia screening. Now, we're fortunate this committee knows more than most people about dyslexia screening, having been involved in the passing of SB 612 with the help of professionals and grassroots organizations. So our discussion today, if you just check. Ah, it works. How about that? Not to go through all of dyslexia, that would take 8 or 10 weeks, but we can agree on some things about dyslexia. It's good to get them out in the open. And the first is that it is a specific learning disability that is neurobiological in origin, and that is the definition from the International Dyslexia Association and adopted by many states as well. It has nothing to do with the eyes, for example. Early identification and assessment and proper interventions can help avoid negative outcomes. And we say early identification, we mean when a child is learning to read, not when they're 8 or 9 or 12 or 13. And early screening for those at risk for dyslexia is a good starting point, getting positive early indications that a child is at risk for dyslexia. And again, dyslexia has nothing to do with the eyes. So what makes a good screening method? Well, you go to the doctor, you get a drop of blood sampled, and on the basis of that, you get some other tests. That's a screening method. It's quick, it's simple, it's understood. So a screening method should be fast and easy, convenient and practical. Take a minimal, for dyslexia, take a minimal amount of time from the classroom, from the school, for any kind of processing. And it should have a clear result that's easy to understand. A screening method should be objective, which means that everything is measured in the same way. The results should be able to be aggregated and compared. For example, if you get a whole classroom tested, you should be able to compare kids in that class to those in other classes and other schools, or even look at a whole school district or a whole state if you could. And another good criteria for a screening method is that it should be independent of the reading curriculum. That is, not tied to any particular way of intervening or providing interventions for the correction or remediation or support of dyslexia. Finally, and this is the crux, it should be accurate. It should identify the right children and not identify some children incorrectly as in so-called false positives. And it should be evidence-based and backed up by scientific theory. So with no further ado, I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Fredrik Vetterhall, the CEO of Optilexia in Sweden. He's here in the Northwest to attend a Microsoft conference on education. Microsoft has designated Optilexia, the company and the technology, as the best cloud solution in education. They've also produced, Microsoft has produced a book called Cloud for Global Good recently, in which Optilexia is one of the seven examples cited, along with the United Nations. He will tell us about a new technology that is revolutionizing dyslexia screening. Mr. Vetterhall.
All right. Thank you so much. My name is Fredrik Vetterhall. I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here. Just a few words about Optilexia. So we have developed a completely new method for early rapid and reliable detection of dyslexia. And the reason we have done this is that we've seen so many kids that are identified way too late, usually in the end of elementary school or even later, in many cases never. And if that happened, that will affect their self-esteem, it will affect all subjects in school, it will affect their motivation to read and learn, it will affect their future career opportunities as well as life in general. So that's why we believe this is so important. And today, there are a lot of methods to find kids with dyslexia early. The challenge is that these are quite resource and time consuming, which means that in reality, it's very rarely done in schools. So what we have seen is that if you're going to do this today, you need to do a lot of tests, test different components of reading, and that will take a lot of time from the pupils as well as from the school. What we want to do is we want to have a simpler way to find these kids with one easy method that only takes a couple of minutes. Still, you need to do all the steps afterwards, like further assessment, intervention, and then follow up. So we only do screening. With our method, we can find these kids early, in the beginning of elementary school, when they start to learn to read. This will save a lot of valuable years compared to today's situation. And our method is also very time and resource effective. It only takes around 2 minutes per kid. It doesn't require any manual handling or administration by the school, which means that you can really do this in big scale, and it really works in practice. It's also a completely objective method, since we only used iGaze data for the assessment. And this means that we can really create an equal school. You're not dependent on your teacher or which school you are in. Everyone will be assessed in the same kind of way. This also means that you can compare results between classes, teachers, school, regions, etc., and allocate resources accordingly. We can also show that we can find the right kids who have very high accuracy, both when it comes to identifying the kids at risk of dyslexia as well as excluding kids not at risk of dyslexia. The way we do it is that we use eye tracking artificial intelligence to accomplish this. And here are two examples how it could look like. So what we do is that we look at the reading pattern from the kids. And in the example in the top here, you can see a kid that is quite good in reading. The size of the circle represents how long you stay in a certain spot in the text, and then you can see how you move around in the text. In the other example, you can see a kid struggling with the reading. This is actually a cognitive process in the brain trying to interpret the text. So this is the kind of information that we're using, and we let the computer do the assessment to make it objective and fast and accurate. So it works like this. The kid read a short text on a computer screen. We record their eye movements while they read the text. Then we send it to a computer and apply machine learning algorithms, artificial intelligence. A few seconds later, we have a result, a prediction, if the kid's at risk of having dyslexia or not. And that kind of information is sent then accessible by the schools via a web portal. And it could look like this, that we identify kids. So you can aggregate information up to state level if you want. You can have it on district level, school level, class level, and as well as on the student level. The experience we have so far is that we say that around 10 to 15% of the population has dyslexia, but we can see it's not evenly distributed. So we can see some schools have a lot of kids with extra need, and other schools doesn't have that. So it's not allocating resources just based on the number of kids is not probably the best thing to do. So with this kind of solution, you can really see how many kids you have in the school or in the class or in the region. And today, we are doing pilots here in the U.S. We did one in Minnesota in October, and next week we're starting new pilots in Atlanta and in Minnesota. And these are to validate the model for English. We also planned pilots in the U.K. We're also doing it in France today. So our ambition is to add more languages, like Arabic, for instance, and then we can test all kids very early, even if they're immigrants, for instance. Yeah.
And on a more local level, what we're doing in Oregon, well, we're very fortunate to be here and share this information with you today. Yesterday, we shared the information with your colleagues in the House Education Committee. And tomorrow, we're going to be meeting people who are closer to the front lines. Region 1, people from districts and schools who are concerned about how dyslexia should be measured, screened for, addressed, etc. So with that, we want to thank you for the time to make this presentation, and if you have any questions, please.
Senator Lipkin.
Thank you for taking a question. These rapidity or speed with which you can push kids through this and develop the AI technology, it sounds like a fantastic idea. 25 years of research, this screen that I'm looking at, the slide after the current activity slide, said 3,000 children studied in 2015-16. That sounds like a real small population segment. During a single year, I'm imagining a school system could far exceed that, and I'm wondering, 2,000 children screened commercially, that's a total of 5,000 in a year's time, I'm assuming that's 2015. I would expect you to, for your AI testing, to have a gigantic population of testing.
Yeah, that's a relevant question. The study we have done so far during 2015 and 16, made in Sweden, around 3,000 kids, where half of these have been also screened with 1 year ahead. I would say that if you look in other kind of I'm not a researcher myself, but if you look in other kind of studies, this is quite a big number. And we can train our model to be even better, but we have seen that the number of kids we have today is fairly enough, actually. The reason we have only screened 2,000 kids commercially is that we recently launched our method in Sweden. And we have scientific articles also published around our method. And the good thing here is that we have data from 91 also, so we have longitudinal studies where they've followed these kids for 25 years. We really knew the kind of problems they have in 91 still persisted 25 years later. So it's a combination of all this.
Sure. Thank you.
And we are going to look at this. As you know, we passed a bill last year, and we have some screenings in process. But I think the one thing that excited me the most is I really would like to be able to identify kids early. Those of us who have dyslexia who really didn't learn to read till we were in middle school, most of my friends that had that problem were not very successful all the way through the school system. A few of us, for whatever reason, overcame it to the extent that we could actually be successful in school. Still can't spell, still can't do a lot of other things, but
that's not important. That's why you have spell check on your computer.
But you have to have, you have to spell well enough that the check has an idea. I'm just telling you.
That's true.
It's always embarrassing when it tells me that it has no idea what I was trying to spell.
It happens to me a lot too.
But it is really difficult, and if you don't have parents and others that are willing to understand and keep working with you on your individual feelings about yourself, it's pretty easy to go the opposite direction. And I have a number of friends from elementary school who were not very successful, always were happy that I was, but school and making it through were not necessarily in their, they did not consider it an option for them, so they went off on other things. So I'm looking forward to looking at more of the evidence and reading the articles and doing the other stuff, but I felt that people here in Oregon needed to have an opportunity, and I'm happy you did this also in the House side. I appreciate your time. Good luck with your adventures with the school districts and other people you're going to talk to. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Roblin, on the committee. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And thanks for making it relatively short. That was really nice.
Yeah, we tried.
So we're going to close our informational hearing on optalexia, and we've got 20 minutes. You want to get started? Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 318, and I don't expect, because we looked at the numbers, that we have a lot of people that want to speak to it. I hope that if there are people, did you have an order that you would like to, would you like to go down? And
you know, my staff has suggested I not talk anymore today. Oh. So,
so most of the people I apparently know each other, and we have groups of three that we have set up to have a conversation. The question is, I want to make sure that people who can't make it back on Tuesday of next week get a chance to go first, because we will be, anybody that doesn't get done, we're going to set this over to Tuesday. So are the first three on the list, whose name is?
Michelle probably.
Rowland.
Rowland Schwartz.
Schwartz. Megan Foster and Taylor Rosenthal.
And she traveled the furthest, so we can bring her up here today.
So I'm happy, and then there's another group, and we'll see as far as we can get. But I certainly appreciate you being here. We'll have a short explanation about the bill from our administrator, and then we're going to let you guys take us to the end, or the next group.
Fantastic.
So, yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 318 requires the Department of Education to provide technical assistance and support to school districts and community colleges for prevention of and response to interpersonal violence, including sexual assault. It establishes program requirements.
Very good. It's all yours.
Fantastic. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Roland Schwartz. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, a statewide nonprofit with over 100 multidisciplinary members that serve on one of eight subcommittees, two of which, our campus subcommittee and our prevention and education subcommittee, helped develop the language and efforts behind this bill. I am joined today with our prevention coordinator, Megan Foster, who will be here today, and if we end up coming back next week, will serve as our technical expert and answer any questions that you all might have. We are really proud to be here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 318, which will strengthen our state-level violence prevention efforts in K-12 and improve community college response by establishing critical staffing at the Oregon Department of Education. Senate Bill 318 exemplifies our mission to support a collaborative, survivor-centered approach to the prevention of and response to violence in Oregon. The overarching goal of Senate Bill 318 is to create healthy communities for Oregonians, free from violence, free from bullying, free from harassment. This is truly a vision that the task force holds and our membership holds, and we see the positions that this bill would establish as the building blocks to create a healthier Oregon. Preventing violence before it begins requires us to invest in and support youth identifying and developing healthy relationships. Improving our response to violence in educational settings requires that we provide trauma-informed interventions provided by trustworthy adults who are able to ensure student rights and that the students' rights and needs are met. The risk of violence is represented not in just in K through 12, but also through a student's academic career leading into college. Of the nearly 350,000 students enrolled in one of Oregon's 17 community colleges, one in five women will experience sexual violence while they're enrolled in school, and one in 71 men will experience sexual violence in their lifetime. The widespread impact of trauma on Oregon students impacts their ability to fully engage in academic life, resulting in chronic absenteeism, poor academic results, and dropout rates. Oregon does have an excellent foundation upon which to build successful violence prevention and response. However, our schools across Oregon currently lack the infrastructure, technical assistance, and support to fully implement effective prevention and response services. Senate Bill 318 will strengthen our statewide infrastructure by establishing two specific positions. One is a violence prevention specialist, which will increase a position that currently exists at Oregon Department of Education to full-time, and that position will help K through 12 with implementing prevention efforts. The other position would be one FTE, a Title IX specialist, which will actually help our K through 12 and community colleges specifically with implementing best practice and trauma-informed practices in response to federal mandates that they're required to meet. The two positions will weave prevention and response efforts, creating a bridge between Oregon's secondary schools and community colleges. Senate Bill 318 is a cost-effective, proactive approach that will leverage the success of many state bipartisan accomplishments passed in previous sessions, including the Healthy Teen Relationship Act, Aaron's Law, the Coordinated Student Health Success Act, Campus Sexual Assault, the Senate Bill 759, and Advocate Privilege, while also responding to federal Title IX and Cleary amendments. Mandates. Passage of Senate Bill 318 will establish the support necessary to build healthier, safer communities where Oregon students will thrive and reach their full potential. And for these reasons, we urge your support. I'm available for any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move down. Did you have anything to say this time, or are you here for technical support?
She's here for technical
Chair
support.
Robles, I'm here for technical support, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you all have today, as well as Tuesday if we continue there.
Oh, make sure
Sorry,
we know.
My name is Megan Foster.
Thank you, Megan.
Record.
Okay.
Hi, Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Linthicum. My name is Taylor Rosenthal, and I'm the Prevention and Outreach Program Coordinator for Haven from Domestic and Sexual Violence in the Dalles, Oregon. So I drove long ways for this. So I'm very excited to be here to testify for Senate Bill 318.
But we are heading out. Our Ways and Means, we're driving tomorrow to Hermiston. So we're, you know.
Have fun.
Yeah.
It's very cold out there. And I think the highway's actually shut down right now.
That's what I was afraid of. So we're hoping that it warms up tonight.
Yeah. So Haven, the agency that I work for, serves Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler counties. Haven also provides services to surrounding communities along the Columbia River Gorge and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. During my time at Haven, the prevention education program has continued to build capacity beyond Wasco County schools to include middle and high schools throughout our service area. Our farthest school is roughly 2.5 hours south of the Dalles and is in the frontier community of Wheeler County. Many of the rural and frontier schools that we partner with lack the capacity to implement the unfunded mandates, such as the Healthy Teen Relationship Act and Aaron's Law. Just last week, one of the principals that we work with requested that we help them plan how to implement Aaron's Law, not knowing entirely what that included. We have another leader in one of our counties that we serve express that sexual assault doesn't happen in their community. I am sure we can all agree that based on the most recent findings from the Count Her In, from the Women's Foundation of Oregon, sexual assault happens everywhere. Our greatest captive audience is in the schools. I consider myself an expert in my field and believe that prevention education is not only important but crucial to change Oregon. In 2016, Haven served 441 primary survivors, 93 of those identifying sexual assault as their primary victimization for teens and adults. Haven's program was able to provide 230 school-based educational sessions that allowed us to have 4,016 student contacts throughout 2016. Our prevention program continues to receive invites to meet the needs of different schools and communities in our service area. Because of Haven's lack of capacity, we unfortunately are not able to meet all of the requests at the level we know to be effective. Additionally, as the co-chair of the Statewide Prevention Education Committee, I support Senate Bill 318. One of the supports that the Task Force Prevention Education Committee offers is to support primary prevention programs around the state working with schools. Primary prevention funding is severely lacking, and unfortunately, there's not the capacity to meet the needs around the state. This bill will support FTE to strengthen state-level violence prevention efforts in K-12 education and improve community college response by supporting statewide implementation of the Healthy Teen Relationship Act and Aaron's Law. Also to support academic achievement and retention by addressing bullying, harassment, and incidents of violence, and continue to strengthen the bond between sexual health promotion and violence prevention, positioning schools and prevention programs for success and better outcomes. This bill will also support efforts and compliance with Title IX and the Clery Act, with attention on trauma-informed, survivor-centered practices, support statewide implementation of students' rights and privacy laws. So, thank you, and I will.
Thank you. Any questions for this group?
Direct them.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
And for coming a long way.
Thank you. Thanks. I shall head back there now.
Cheryl. Is it Hestema? Estra?
Hemstra.
Hemstra. Megan. Kovacs.
And Kristen.
And Kristen. Boy, they always have a nice long name.
Schlotterbeck.
Thank you. My dyslexia comes through every time I see these long names.
For
it's a B and a D and
my
a D.
Entire life growing up, I was baptized by the same priest that I grew up around, and he could never say my last name right the whole time that I was schooled.
Who are we missing?
From DOJ, Cheryl had to take.
Okay.
I think that there's DOJ testimony in the.
Oh. Okay.
In all this.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Go ahead and start.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Megan Kovacs. I am the program manager with the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance. Sexual violence is preventable. With strong policy, advocacy, and access to education and support for healthy relationships, sexual violence is prevented. And Oregon boasts some of the best, most comprehensive policies and some of the most passionate advocates for healthy relationships in the country. We have the necessary prevention elements to put our state ahead of the curve when it comes to preventing violence and ensuring that all young people have access to education and support for healthy relationships. However, what is lacking here, despite our best intentions, are the resources for infrastructure to ensure all young people have equal and equitable access to violence prevention and healthy relationships promotion across the state. Although teaching about consent, communication, respect, and trust within interpersonal relationships are included as primary outcomes within Oregon standards and benchmarks for health education, the Oregon Department of Education is currently lacking the capacity to ensure standardized implementation across the state. This is why I support Senate Bill 318. In my 10 years teaching about healthy relationships and violence prevention in high schools and middle schools, I saw that every teacher I worked with used a different curriculum, a different program, or a different method for teaching the young people in their community. Now, in my current role as program manager with the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance, I'm also seeing this true across the state. It is true that every community has different needs in addressing what it means to practice a healthy relationship and to prevent violence. However, I've also witnessed a lack of training, technical assistance, and support for educators, administrators, and healthcare providers about how to talk to young people about healthy relationships and how to prevent violence. Although we have the policies and passion, we have not, as a state, made the investment in the necessary infrastructure to support Oregon's young people to have healthy relationships. Often, responsibility for implementation of these policies in schools falls on community nonprofits, which tend to be chronically underfunded. Currently, I distribute small grants to school-based health centers across the state to implement projects to promote healthy relationships in their communities. It's up to me to provide funds, training, and infrastructure to support these efforts. Underfunded, already overworked domestic and sexual violence programs are implementing education in high schools and middle schools to help fill the gap because many educators across the state feel unprepared and unable to talk about dating and sexual violence prevention with the young people they teach. These programs are doing effective and important work in their communities, but this model, without any kind of systemization and accountability, is unsustainable. The Oregon Department of Education has a long history of providing excellent training, technical assistance, and support to Oregon's educators. Currently, though, they lack the capacity to be able to support the implementation of necessary health promotion and violence prevention policies. This bill will fill that gap. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 318. Preventing sexual violence in Oregon depends on it. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Kristen Schlatterbeck. I'm with Clackamas Women's Services. Apologies, my voice is not what it usually is. So hopefully you can all hear me. I can't hear myself very well. I'm the Community Education Program Manager with Clackamas Women's Services. We are a community-based nonprofit in Clackamas County serving domestic violence, sexual violence victims, as well as victims of stalking, elder abuse, and sex trafficking. Part of our education program includes violence prevention programming, where we send educators who are specially trained out into the middle schools and high schools within Clackamas County to teach during their health classes. We use a 10-session curriculum that teaches students how to recognize dating and sexual violence, but most importantly, how to intervene when they see other students in relationships that are unhealthy or other students involved in behavior that could be harmful. We provide these lessons to 16 different schools across the county, to reaching about 8,000 students and growing each year. We know that rates of gender-based violence continue to be high. Based on the Oregon Health Authority's 2005 Healthy Teen Survey, 13% of Clackamas County 11th graders identified as, quote, giving in to sexual activity when they didn't want to because of pressure. 5.8 identify as, quote, being physically forced to have sexual intercourse when they didn't want to. By the same survey, 4.6% experienced physical violence at the hands of a dating partner and 23.5% at the hands of an adult. This survey is administered every 2 years, and the rates of children experiencing violence at the hands of a dating partner have not declined. In addition, we know that from the Southern Poverty Law Center that rates of hate crimes have also been recently on the rise. Clackamas County is incredibly diverse. We work with schools who are well-funded, affluent areas, urban areas. We also work with very small schools out in our farthest rural areas. Across all these schools, we see the need is the same. Children are growing up without many powerful models of healthy relationships. There's a great need for them to learn how to share their power, how to communicate across disagreements and different backgrounds, and how to show their friends an empathetic and helping hand. Senate Bill 318 would help teachers and administrators at our schools and at schools across the state get the support that they need to provide the type of education in the most effective ways, even when there are not additional community resources to support them. And students want to learn these things too. I've included, though I'm not sure if my materials got sent on prior, but I've included some feedback from our students about the impact that lessons about dating violence and sexual violence have had on their lives. And I'll pass those on so that you can review them as well. I want to thank you all for your time in considering Senate Bill 318 and the impact that it will have on young people across the state. And I urge you to make a commitment to support, to decrease the experience of violence through your support of the Senate bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
No real questions, thank you.
Okay, we're good. Thank you very much. Next, we have Erica, Carly, and Brenda. And on deck is Nikki. And we may get to her, otherwise we'll bring her back. Oh. So just go right ahead, whoever wants to start.
Sure. Hi, folks. Good afternoon. My name is Carly Runner, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, members of the committee.
And you can sit back a little bit. If you're too close,
absolutely.
It's not good.
Sure. My name is Carly Runner, for the record, and I coordinate advocacy and prevention services at Willamette University. The primary goal of violence prevention in Oregon's public education system and our numerous college and university settings is to enable the young people of our state to live lives to their fullest potential, free of the emotional, physical, and financial effects of sexual and relationship violence. As a prevention educator and advocate, I feel especially privileged to work in Oregon, where we actively assist our K-12 youth to establish healthy relationships and the building blocks of nonviolence. In Oregon, we're uniquely situated to provide the foundation of healthy relationships and prevention programming to a substantial portion of our youth via our K-12 and community college programs. But as our students become aware and able to address instances of sexual and relationship violence, we must also have a robust system that it provides trauma-informed care to those students whose lives do intersect with violence during the term of their education. We cannot escape the mutuality of prevention and response efforts. How we treat survivors directly impacts students' perceptions of our prevention messages and vice versa. To ensure that the systems of prevention and response function at their utmost capacity, we must support educators that assist our youth to be trauma-informed and have access to current best practices and resources in their field. In my experience, technical assistance has been an invaluable tool that I am able to use and allows people in my position throughout our state to fully do our work and be truly effective. We know that as we build communities that do not tolerate violence and actively and competently support those who have been affected by it, our students go on to face better health outcomes, contributing to their fullest capacity and relieving the financial and resource burdens for our government and our university institutions. Metaphorically, prevention and response are two sides of the same coin. Each must equally be strong in order to best serve our students and their needs going forward. This is why Senate Bill 318 is so critically important to the continuation of our prevention and response efforts here in Oregon. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I welcome any questions that you have.
Thank you very much.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and members of the committee, my name is Erica Rothman, and I'm the Title IX co-coordinator. Excuse me. Suffering from some of the same ailments affecting many of your constituents today. I'm here to discuss how the proposed bill might affect community colleges, and as my colleague Ms. Roner just mentioned, prevention and education being two sides of the same and response being two sides of the same coin. My remarks primarily concern response because that is the thing that I am consumed with in my role, but I fully recognize that those two are inextricably interwoven. PCC is the largest public college in Oregon by far, serving more than 80,000 students, faculty, and staff. But Oregon is home to a number of smaller community colleges as well, whose impact is no less profound. Community colleges are a gateway for many first-generation college students, and community colleges provide affordable alternatives to a traditional four-year institution with certification and vocational programs. Community colleges also offer a stepping stone with transfer degrees, and with Oregon Promise ramping up, that stepping stone is now afforded to more Oregonians than ever, as I probably don't need to tell this committee. Because we are a point of entry into this world of higher education, we are at a unique crossroads between the needs of traditional four-year institutions, K-12 institutions, and the greater workforce. We serve a number of populations who are typically more vulnerable than average to sexual misconduct, such as students aged 16 to 24, students with disabilities, students of color, immigrant and other students with possible language barriers. Our diversity is our strength. Our diversity also overlaps with identities and factors known to be known to increase risk of sexual assault or other misconduct. And as such, our student support services must be comprehensive when it comes to addressing student sexual safety and education about healthy relationships. We, PCC, and other community colleges are uniquely situated to address some of these concerns, given that we sit at some of these crossroads, but we're also struggling to allocate resources we need to respond to the broad array of Title IX-related concerns. At PCC, I'm very fortunate to have some helping hands, a team, really, because my institution is enormous. But some of my smaller community college colleagues are not so fortunate. In addition to being tasked with the full ambit of Title IX and related state legislation, an HR director will also be the sole Title IX administrator. So that's response and prevention and all of their HR duties, or perhaps all of their dean of students duties in one individual. Many of my colleagues in the campus subcommittee of the task force do not have their heads above water. And so I feel very fortunate to be able to call on my enormous institution to borrow some folks, but I'm borrowing them. Indeed, all of my helping hands have other roles at the college, and we need as much as we can get in the way of support and resources for sexual misconduct, sex education, and technical assistance. Technical assistance in particular has been immeasurably helpful in helping us navigate the overlay between a number of federal, state, and local guidelines. The conflicts that law of law that arise in this field are extremely complex, and having a savvy legal technician in Salem to help us untangle interstices of this legal area would be very, very beneficial to my community, to my colleagues, and myself. Clear policy and procedure ultimately also benefits our students. Once our students know their rights and responsibilities and resources on their campuses, they can better navigate those campuses and seek their education. So as the higher ed legal landscape gets more complex, so too do the needs of our students, and thereby our needs as well. I support this bill, and I'm able to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy. I'm here to offer a survivor voice. In 1998, I was gang raped by four college football players. Two of them went to Oregon State University. I came forward with my story about 2.5 years ago, and have been advocating and traveling the country, speaking at different colleges and with numerous survivors. And I'm here to talk about the crisis that we are facing here in Oregon, and that has to do with sexual assault and rape. 1 in 5 young girls will be the victim of a sexual assault or a rape before she is 18. 1 in 5 on our campuses. We can no longer just continue to just intervene, just respond. We have to start putting money and resources into also prevention, which is what I love about Bill 318, is we have some prevention in there. And response is also good. But when I say crisis, I mean crisis. If I was saying to you 1 in 4 or 5, you know, young people in our school system was going to contract a lethal meningitis strain by the time of 18 in our school system, or 1 in 5 college students, we would be responding to this situation much differently. We have somehow become immune to the numbers, but these are real lives, and this is ruining lives. The cost alone of rape for a single victim is estimated at $100,000. 75% of women who are in drug and alcohol rehabilitation have been the victims of sexual assault. 73% of all of those seeking bariatric surgery have been the victims of sexual assault. So what I'm saying by that, and by throwing those numbers at you, is that this is a widespread issue of vast proportions in our society. And we have to start putting more money into prevention. We cannot talk about suicide rates and threat assessments and violence and dropout rates and all of these things without addressing violence. And especially sexual assault, especially rape, especially domestic violence and dating violence. We are doing a disservice to our young children by not pouring more money into these services. This is, I love Senate Bill 318, but what I don't like about it is I think it's not enough. We should be doing more than just this. This is a small, small ask, and it absolutely should be passed. And if it's not, then I think that is doing a huge disservice to the children who we should be protecting and educating and helping to foster a safe life for all of them so they can have a good future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I would say, Brenda, thank you for your persistence.
Thank you. I'm not going anywhere.
Nothing happens in our state very easily. It takes time. And having been here for your previous testimony, I am one of the people who believes strongly that it will be people like you who make sure we hear and listen to the facts that eventually get us to move where we need
exactly.
to
go. Exactly. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Any other questions? Thank you all for being
thank
here.
Thank you.
Nikki, if you can do it in a couple minutes, we can get you. We can get all of the testimony done for this bill.
You're good.
And not bad. And you can thank, if we keep it, hold it over, it'll only be so that Senator Gelser can testify it on her own bill. Let her staff.
Well, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, we always like to hear from Senator Gelser. Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I'd like to just start by saying I am absolutely humbled to follow the panels that I have followed. And in light of their expertise and the people that you've heard from who do the work on the ground and live with this
strife every day. I will be very brief. The Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence represents 50 plus nonprofit community-based victim services organizations, including now on tribal lands and reservations. We have places, a safe shelter and safe harbor all across the state. And in a long, long time ago, in a session far, far away, we had worked on the Healthy Teen Relationship Act. This is that next building block. This is taking that piece of foundation and really making it meaningful. Full implementation of that means that we've got that position at the community college campuses where life and education really intersect in a neat and interesting and acute way. And it also means that we're going to have some more attention through K through 12. The people we serve are mostly those who don't want to report into the system. They won't go into the district attorney's office, and we'd like to see less of them. And if we're really going to be tackling this in a comprehensive way, we've got to start early and see it all the way through and not just be able to meet them in the most acute time for triage. And so this is one way that we can do that, and the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence wholeheartedly supports this step.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Nikki? Seeing none, thank you, Nikki. So that, unless there's anybody else out there who was just got excited by the testimony and wants to now testify, I think we're looking okay. So with that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 318. I don't have any other business of the committee, so I will adjourn the Senate Committee on Education. Senate Committee on Education. Turn the